organized for the Academy of National Academy of Sciences annual meeting, which begins tomorrow, and how everything is being moved out of the main building and even out of the Georgetown facility, which is across the way. And if you notice, every room in this hotel and probably several others are being used for various NRC functions. And so we were lucky to find the room. The committee has added two new members since the last meeting. And I guess in the material that we've distributed on the outside, they are listed. One of them, Emma Keeler, is here at this meeting, and Kevin Murphy, who has joined the committee and has begun to interact with others here. Kevin is from Penn State University, was unable to come to this session, but has already begun to share materials with the committee. I thought it would be just useful to go around the table and then around the outside of the room and let people quickly identify themselves. And then we'll, in particular, and as we do that, we have three members of the committee who were not present at the first meeting, and Emmett, who's here for the first time. And I would ask them to take more than the 10 seconds of introduction and tell everyone just a little bit about yourself and why you think you're here at the table. So let me begin. I'm Stephen Feinberg. I'm a statistician from Carnegie Mellon University and chair of the committee.
I'm John Swartz. I'm an experimental cognitive psychologist, emeritus from a company in Cambridge called DBM Technologies, and loosely affiliated with all the
companies. I'm Patricia Brown. I'm a biostatistician from the University of Minnesota.
I'm Mark Brinkel, a neurologist,
I'm Richard Schifrin. By the name I heard, so I guess it's at 12 seconds. I'm able to attend this meeting. I am at Indiana University. I'm a cognitive psychologist. I study memory, attention, perception, learning.
George Maschke, also with antipolicy.org.
Drew Richardson, I'm an agent with the FBI here, simply in the private capacity.
Cecilia Roster, NRC staff.
Important people. Thank you. As Chris mentioned, Paul Stern, who is the study director for this project, is not with us. He has some impending surgery, but he's been involved in things. We chatted yesterday on my way down. He's really sorry that he's not here to interact with us. Sorry. However, Chris has been terrific going in. And she's going to be on. He never said, "Oh, let me sit by myself."
That was established at the request also of the Department of Energy this late last fall. We had an 18-month mandate. We did provide an interim report, a briefing, really, to Secretary Richardson before he left office. And I can get some questions about that if you'd like. And we are continuing our investigation through the spring. Our next meeting is coming up here in the third week of May. Our commission is chaired by John Hamry, former Deputy Secretary of Defense, and now the President and CEO of the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Science, CSIS, as well as Terry Burgess, who you just said earlier. We have a 20-member commission. We have a very broad representation of distinguished individuals drawn, I would say, roughly from three types of backgrounds. People who have had experience with the Department of Energy in the past or are presently engaged, including with DOE laboratories, individuals from the science community, the science background, distinguished scientists, and then roughly speaking, a third group of people who have a background in the defense community and the intelligence community. So it's a pretty broad group of people. We also have Senator Baker and Lee Hamilton as ex officio members. They're on the commission because of the work of the Baker-Hamilton report. We felt it very important to build on the work that has been done already looking at the Department of Energy. The commission has been asked to look at a number of issues at the nexus of science and security. We have a broad mandate. In general, DOE, I think, is concerned that they are able to continue to maintain their world-class scientific institutions while protecting national security. We were set up in the wake of some a number of events and questions about the impact of the new directives that were issued in the wake of these events, including the Wendell Lee investigation and the missing disk drives, and their impact on the conduct of the new directives' impact on the conduct of scientific research, and the question of whether they, in fact, actually enhance security. We've been asked, I would point out, to look not only at the weapons laboratories, where there's a great deal of classified work conducted, but also at the scientific laboratories. So we have a list of 22 laboratories, three weapons labs. There are, of course, a number of major science labs, and all together a list of, if you count them, 22. And that's important because, it's fair to say that in the course of our investigation so far, we found a spillover effect at the science labs from the weapons labs that I would say is in part because DOE as an institution has in the past tended to want to impose what are known as one-size-fits-all solutions. That approach, I think, has certainly begun to change in the last number of months, but it's still very much an issue for headquarters and for the labs. There are three key areas that we've been asked to examine. Scientific exchange, that would be visits and travel, a whole array of interactions with foreign nationals, cooperation among the laboratories as well as with other institutions, and that includes universities, and it includes the question of recruitment and retention, where I think the polygraph issue as a policy issue really comes to the fore. We've been asked to look at the conduct of research and the protection of information that is both classified and unclassified, and it's fair to say that one issue we'll be looking at rather extensively is the question of unclassified information, because the Department of Energy does seek to control certain unclassified information, and I can come back to that if there are questions there. And I would say, roughly speaking, the third area is cybersecurity, where there is broad agreement, I would say, among the commissioners thus far, and certainly many people within the DOE complex, that there's much more work to be done. I think it's fair to say that the question of personnel security is embedded in all three of these areas. I did mention recruitment and retention in particular. But where the question of personnel security is involved does today for polygraph. In terms of the kind of work we've done, the methodology, we've been to 8 laboratories so far, including the 3 of the weapons labs. We've heard a lot about polygraph and the concerns of scientists, which you all are acutely aware. And we've also made a visit to the Polygraph Institute in Albuquerque, which your commission has done as well. One of our commissioners visited the institute, and that was myself and another of our staff members. We're holding our second meeting now, the third week of May, and there, among other things, we're going to begin to explore security models that have been successful, security models outside the Department of Energy, within the government, but also outside the government. And I think one aspect of our examination of those models will be personnel security and how you develop personnel security measures that are part of a whole system and that are organic to the mission of the institution. So I think I'll stop there, but I will say that we are very interested in your work and in staying in close touch with what you are doing, and we would like very much also, you know, we're very prepared to be helpful in any way we can.
I realized that as you began to talk that although we were told about the commission at our first meeting, indeed that's when my first knowledge of it, that I haven't seen a list of commission members, and I think it would be very useful for us to have that, and we can have it reproduced for people.
I think we have come prepared with such a list and with reproduction.
Another handout, maybe the next thing I'm going to ask is there.
Yes, Terry's always prepared.
I have three things on my initial list. The mandate of the commission.
Here you go. Now, I'm passing out that mandate with a cautionary note. This is our original mandate. There may be some slight changes to it from Secretary Abraham. Yeah, but we anticipate that it will remain largely unchanged.
And the third thing is you mentioned an interim report. Does it exist in physical form?
That was a briefing, really. It was a briefing for Secretary Richards. I'm prepared to talk to you.
You mentioned at the end something about successful security models. I wonder if one has found any in this, how you define success.
Those are both very good questions. And let me answer this in the best way I know how. We are talking to individuals who have been involved in creating security models. We need to speak with them more extensively to learn some of the details. One example of a system that I think we would define as successful because the secret was kept would be the stealth fighter program. That's one example. We'll be talking to an individual who is involved in creating a security system for the stealth fighter program. We are bringing in an individual who is responsible for security at Lincoln Laboratories at MIT, and they are reputed to have successful security systems.
On that point,
those are a couple of examples.
Does it go beyond examples? Is there research on these security models that have gone into a breach for Microsoft? Or is it all anecdotal?
To the best of my knowledge, it is anecdotal. There may well be a scientific research available, but to the best of my knowledge,
just follow up one aspect of that. Assuming that the stealth fighter program includes the polygraph component of the security system,
yes.
I don't know what they're running into.
Yes, there's a call back to comment. for certain of the individuals with certain clearances, there is regular screening done for the individuals. So that everyone can get out and check all of that we need to check. I'll also say that we're looking outside the government. We're still working on drawing in individuals, though, but people who are involved with security in the private sector. But obviously, polygraphs would not be a device to use.
Excited to hear your remarks and some academic details that you get up to on this. What is DOE's interest in protecting classified information?
Well, that's a very good question, and we are investigating that question, so I can't say I have a scientific answer to it. There are certain, apparently, certain types of unclassified information that don't necessarily rise in the Department of Energy's view to the, and in some cases, the view of other government agencies to a level that would make that information classifiable. And so they have sought to bound it in other, I would say, less defined, some would say ill-defined ways. And frankly, this causing a great deal of difficulty for a number of the scientists because it places the burden in some cases on them to try to figure out what it is that they ought not to be talking about. And this is a real problem. Now, I'm speaking about sensitive unclassified information in a generic way. There are certain types of information that are export controlled. And I won't go into it here because there's another National Academy of Sciences workshop, in fact, that's taking place next week, that is looking at this question. This information is subject to something called deemed export. So that when you talk about this information to a foreign national, information on a certain, that fits within a certain definition, you can be exporting that information in your life. Another area of great difficulty, and as I say, with CSIS actually, has been looking at this question, and there's going to be a workshop on it next week. There are other areas of sensitive unclassified information, something called, they have something called sensitive subjects list. So if you something falls onto that list, and you're going to talk about it with a foreign national, the meeting, the travel or the visit needs to be screened by the Department of Energy headquarters. And this is something that we're going to be looking at very closely because this information is not defined or governed by statute. And we have a lot of questions about it.
So if somebody was asked about contacting an appropriate contact in a polygraph setting, if the question were phrased quite precisely, I'm a DOE employee, and I'm asked a polygraph question about whether I convey unauthorized information like that. It's not precisely stated as whether you convey classified information. It would just cause me difficulty.
I don't need to ask the polygraph examiner that question.
But it confused me to the point.
When you're facing that direction, we have
to... I'm sorry. What I was asking is if there are areas of unclassified information that people are supposed to limit in their communications with foreign nationals. But they're unclassified, and there's confusion, as apparently there is, as to the parameters under which they need to be limited. Could this cause an examinee asked about the conveyance of unauthorized information, say, using the word unauthorized, confusion on the polygraph examiner, and difficulty in the communication?
For that to be successful, in my opinion, you have to have a real defined parameter. Top of all the areas that I don't classify information.
exploring and asking about is the fuller context into which a polygraph examination of a screening sort sits as part of the security in the OE link, in particular for the laboratory. And it affects how we think about criteria, and there will be some discussion of this later on today. And clearly, it's an ongoing topic of concern for the committee. Is there something that your commission is going to look at which is going to allow us to assess the fit between the polygraph and the larger security assessment issues so that one could talk about issues of outcomes, validity, detection of the polygraph, and so on and so forth? I'm not being fully explicit because we haven't, I think, carefully articulated this, but it clearly was a discussion at the first meeting of this committee, and it's been a source of concern as we've explored where the polygraph examination goes, the results go after they're done.
Yeah, well, I think it's fair to say that the commission is interested in how this and other security measures fit together as a whole. You're absolutely right. What other measures either are in place in DOE or might be available to DOE that we can draw, which we can draw in from other models that might be that we might recommend as part of a security system or as for security measures in DOE. So there is interest in getting a better understanding of what a whole model looks like. I don't know if I'm answering your question either. We'll know more too after we meet in May and we advance our discussions with the whole commission on this issue. But it is a crucial, a very important question.
So let me phrase it again, and maybe this is something that we'll want to pursue jointly. I stress that I noticed that both your commission and our committee has the word science in the title, but I think it means something different, although perhaps it has the same connotation. If I take the label on the Commission on Science and Security, science is there largely because the laboratories do science, and so it's security about scientific matters. Am I interpreting the title correctly? Our word science comes before the word evidence, and we're trying to understand the evidentiary basis for the use of the polygraph. And so when we look beyond the polygraph to the larger security setting, we're looking for the evidentiary basis for conclusions with regard to security. We don't quite know how to get that information now, although we've explored this question with people from DOE security. We've talked about this with Andy Ryan and the people at Godfrey. That is, how you judge a case set in that larger context. Are you trying to gather information about that? And if not, is this something that maybe we could both ask about collectively, maybe not get answers?
How do you judge a case in the larger?
Well, the question is how to gather empirical evidence about what is happening in contexts where the polygraph is being used, linked with a broader array of security measures to judge evidence. Because that's science. That's the science.
Just one word that might help. If I say that we always come to us and say, what is the scientific validity of the polygraph in isolation?
Yeah.
Right? And that might be a task that we would take.
here going, you know, very in an anecdotal fashion, when we find the right person, simply going after information, not just doing interviews or seeking data where it is available. Because our mandate is much broader, I would say, though, we are attempting to understand the sequencing of what happens with polygraph results and so forth and so on. We have, I would say, been thus far focusing our efforts more intensively on other areas of our mandate. And I guess that's what I would come back to. We are really headed toward trying to, for ourselves, articulate how science is conducted at the laboratories in the broadest sense, and where that the conduct of scientific research might be headed in the future, the next, say, 10 to 15 years, and then derive from that thinking of them, thinking about what kind of security measures can both allow this conduct of research to go forward successfully, but also provide security. So I think we're operating on a kind of broader level, and really haven't gotten down to that particular detail in the area of the conduct. We're looking to the national
I think I've been in a room where I've done this before with people.
Well, I mean, I'm used to cooperation. Is your report going to be entirely public?
Yes.
Or is it access to the
media? Yes. Yes. No, it will be not
public. I was saying to Chris, I believe that we operate under essentially the same rules, but you're subject to the fact of the rules.
Delighted to, in the first instance, said so far, I think our efforts are complementary. There's not a lot of overlap, but we have staff has informally, I can assure you, attempted to stay in touch thus far, and if it makes sense at any point to include you all, you know, let's talk.
Well, I think one thing that we do not want to have happen is when we issue our report a year from now, roughly, I hope, and our activity ends, for us to say, and this part of what you might have thought our mandate is going to be covered by the report in the Commission of Science and Security, and then your report comes on simultaneously and says the same thing on this topic and points to us. We should not have that happen, and somebody should have the mandate to look at each of the topics at the boundary, and we should make clear how we're doing it, so that we get our acts right. You can choose to deal with that in your own way. But we're very anxious to share material, and did invite Paul to come and actually make a report, and we're not quite sure Paul will back it. Some member of the staff present. Okay. Thank you, and we look forward to continuing to interact in whatever is the appropriate time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Gary, would you be willing to come to the table next?
I'm not going to be proximate to this microphone, but I will. If anybody has trouble hearing, please let me know. A notable 19th century neurologist, John Hewlings Jackson, outlined basic perception on organization of the brain that holds today. He suggested that with evolutionary development of higher neural systems, basic functions come to be re-represented and elaborated on at higher levels of the neuroaxis, but that those basic substrates remain. So you have this hierarchy or tier arrangement of neural structures. And one example comes from responses to aversive stimuli, where at the spinal cord level we see simple pain withdrawal reflexes. Pain stimulus elicits a flexor withdrawal at the level of the brainstem. Once these more elaborated escape and aversive reactions, limbic systems alluded to at your last meeting, that underlie affective processes, conditioned responses to aversive stimuli, and ultimately higher cortical systems that a mediator underlie cognitive contributions to fear, anxiety, aversive reactions. oftentimes these are considered to be organized in a hierarchical fashion with lower level reflex-like substrates that have relatively restricted inputs and outputs, in turn related hierarchically to intermediate and higher level neural structures that can receive information from lower systems and regulate those lower systems. And in fact, the hierarchical features are apparent in the brain, but there are many additional features that defy a simple hierarchy. There are long descending projections that bypass intermediate layers. And conversely, projections from lower levels that proceed directly to the highest level representation could be termed a heterarchical organization.